Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Breakthrough the Noise with me, Jennifer Lindsay. I am the Director of Digital Services and Social Media Evangelist, New Media Guru, all things social media at Eastwick Communications. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. Today on this beautiful Bay Area day, I have the pleasure of speaking with a name you should know, Spencer Christian of ABC7 here in San Francisco, but whose career encompasses a number of notable achievements, including more than a decade on Good Morning America. How are you this morning, Spencer?
I'm fine, Jennifer. How are you?
I'm great. I'm
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you again.
Thank you.
I should let everyone know that our paths crossed once upon a time. I worked at ABC7 and was in charge of new media efforts there when we just called it web at the time.
That's right.
Which actually brings me to my first question. When I was there, and I was there for several years, the new media area or web department was just barely getting integrated into the overall coverage efforts that we were doing,
right.
Which I always found odd because we were called abc7news.com.
Right. We were.
and in the entire time I was there, actually, I think we were technically in the organizational structure under programming.
Right.
And now I see that the show that you co-host daily, A View from the Bay, has its very own website. You broadcast live, I believe, every day from the site. And I'm just wondering, you know, that how has that interaction changed over the years? Has it been a smooth transition, or has it felt jolting at times?
It has felt jolting at times, but I think overall, Jennifer, it has been a smooth transition, but it's also been an ever-changing one. You know, it continues to evolve sometimes almost daily because, when we first began View from the Bay nearly 3 years ago, we didn't even understand how important to the relationship between the live broadcast and the web site could be. But we found that many of our viewers are going to the website after the broadcast to look for segments that they had a particular interest in when we did the live show. And so, you know, we learned very, very early on in our experience on the View from the Bay that it's important to send viewers to the website or drive them to the website, as we say, by reminding them at the end of a segment that you can get more of these tips or more comprehensive information on this topic on the website. And so there's sort of a cross-promotional value, you know, between the live show and the website. On the website, we have information that we hope triggers an interest in watching the live broadcast, and in the live broadcast, we remind people that you can get more information on this topic by going back to the website. And people, we have archived shows, you know, and they can look at shows from the past. And so it's an ever-changing relationship.
So are there any other tools that you guys are looking at using? Like, you know, for example, we use Twitter a lot and Facebook. Are you guys looking at using any of those technologies, for example, to bring questions in? I know you have a live studio audience, so that obviously is a live element that you're already bringing into the picture. But is that something that you're looking at doing or that might be part of the picture soon?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, many of us just became acquainted with Twitter, 3 weeks ago, right, when everyone started talking about it. And so 2 weeks ago, we did a segment on our show, In the View from the Bay, on Twitter to let our viewers know that you can go to twitter.com/abc7/theviewfromthebay and actually post comments, have a conversation, ask questions relating to our show. And now this is so new for us, we don't even know, the extent of its usefulness right now or how significant a role it's going to play in connecting viewers with our broadcast, but we are participating in, we're Twittering. We are Twittering right now. In fact, we had a medical doctor as a guest on our show just a few days ago, and about 10 seconds before we came out of the commercial break that preceded his segment, he said to me in a hushed voice, he said, "Oh, by the way, I Twitter." And I said, "I think you should see a doctor for that." So he started cracking up. But, you know, everyone is eventually, I guess, going to be Twittering, just like we've all been doing simple things, old-fashioned things now, like emailing, you know?
Yeah, and I'm looking on your Twitter stream right now, and we should tell folks again, it's twitter.com/viewfromthebay.
View from the Bay, right.
No A. So just view from the bay. And right now, American Idol winner Taylor Hicks is going to be on the show tomorrow. So is that today?
Oh, today, that's today. Taylor Hicks is on the show today. And
so
as
my
you
husband
know,
is going to be thrilled. You know,
yeah.
He's a huge Taylor Hicks fan, so he's
yeah.
tuning in for that.
Well, I'm a big Taylor Hicks fan, too. He's quite a talented guy, and I'm sure those who are tuned into the podcast now know that he's not only American Idol winner, but starring in the San Francisco production of Grease, which just opened a couple of nights ago. And he participated in a little dating game thing on Regis and Kelly recently, and the young woman who won the date with him is my stepdaughter, my wife's daughter.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. Her name is Julie Courtney, and it's amazing to me because, you know, my wife was the one who talked her into entering this contest to win a date with Taylor Hicks. And so there were, I don't know how many, but many young women around the country who, you know, logged onto Regis and Kelly's website to become a part of this thing. And the viewers of the show went to the website and looked at, you know, the different contestants and their backgrounds and all that and voted for them. So Julie made it to the top three, which means she made it onto the program. So she went to New York and she was one of three contestants to win a date with Taylor. She won the date. They went on to their date. They had a great time. And she is going to be in the segment today on my show along with Taylor.
It is the smallest world ever.
It is. It's a teeny tiny world.
It is. It's so bizarre. And, you know, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is, you know, obviously when we – you know, we're emailing about doing this segment was one of the reasons we do this show is really to keep on top of new perspectives on the idea of influence. Obviously, you hold a lot of influence yourself. You know, you were on GMA for all those years, and I got to tell you, my mom was the biggest Joan Linden fan. So I watched you every morning for a very long time. I won't tell you how old I was. But yeah, and then I ended up working at NBC News during the shift from Tom Brokaw to Brian Williams. So literally, I was, and Steve Kappas, who you know is president of NBC News now, mm-hmm. was the news director of Nightly. So I had this great privilege of watching sort of the tides change between these two very influential people, because, of course, Brian was very influential in cable for his news program then. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, you know, how have you seen influence change within the media in the last few years, especially with the infusion of these new technologies?
You know, Jennifer, that's such a huge question. I don't even know if I have the answer, because I think it was easier, at least for me, to analyze and intelligently discuss the influence of media years ago when the sources of information were fewer. You know, when most people were getting their news from the three old networks, NBC, CBS, and ABC, even in the early days of cable news networks like CNN, I think it was easier to analyze just how great our influence was, how we helped shape public thinking, public opinion, or mm-hmm. How well we informed the public. But now, with the internet out there and all these alternative sources of information that people are turning to, I don't know where the greatest influence lies. I don't know how much people are influenced by television news anymore or by television talk shows. I think it's hard to determine. At least it seems hard for me to determine. I know that people still watch TV and they watch a lot of it, but with so many competing media out there and so many alternate sources of information, many of which, by the way, I don't think are very reliable, really don't know how influential we are anymore. I tried to determine that during the presidential campaign last year, and my gut feeling is that the major television networks, and I'm including the cable news networks as well, like CNN and MSNBC and Fox, I think we are probably less influential now in shaping public opinion than we were 10 or 20 years ago. And frankly, I don't know that we're doing as good a job of informing the public as we did in years past, but I don't know if that's our fault or the fault of a disconnected public.
Yeah, I wonder about two things. One, I can't help but think about, you know, having been at ABC7 and one of the first sort of not fights, but sort of ways I had to stand my ground as a new media enthusiast was when Joe Ahern, God bless him, was our general
mm-hmm.
manager,
yep.
Who's gone on, I think he's still in Chicago now.
Yes.
But he was fighting tooth and nail with myself and my boss about putting the 7-day forecast, and he's had a long career in weather,
yeah.
On the website because he was convinced that no one would tune in if the 7-day forecast was on the website. So that makes me think, you know, obviously, you know, we've always kind of defined, I think, in the media industry, influence as information. You know, we had AccuWeather. So AccuWeather was very big with Joe because there was a large amount of credibility for him
right.
around that the product that they have. So that was very, very important to him. And like you just said, I think, you know, information being unreliable, and we've seen that with Twitter. We've seen people, you know, we forget sometimes, I think, that people are just exchanging information among people. They don't necessarily mean for it to be an actual news source.
Mm-hmm.
And I think
yeah,
that another
right.
piece of this that kind of intersects, and this is where I kind of would love to get your opinion, is I think, you know, TV news kind of has an opportunity, I think, in the sense that newspapers, even maybe our own beloved Chronicle, are going away as we know them. And we
That's
know
right.
newsrooms for the newspaper folks are in disarray. They're changing. Beats are changing on a daily basis, or people have so many beats. The beat system that we even relied on as TV folks, and I remember I started out as a local reporter in Fresno, and I'd go through the daily paper, and you're looking for little nuggets that you can expand upon or provide context or figure out what's been missing. But we always relied really on the beat system of the newspapers that had these deep relationships that could find things, kind of what Dan Noyes does, right? Because
That's
he's
right.
got these amazing relationships. But I see TV having possibly the opportunity to reach out and kind of do some of that beat feel of, you know, and get the pulse of the people. And in terms of view from the Bay, like, it seems to me that, you know, how people can find efficiencies in their lives, for example, or interact with one another. That's
right.
one of the values that you really provide, is actually being able to show people, because we know the visual medium is so, so important.
It
agree,
really is. I agree,
the,
yeah. And
the
you know, there's so much there for me to comment on, so if I start to ramble, jump in and get me back on track, okay?
Ramble.
Okay,
let me
start back at your starting point, which was the AccuWeather 7-day forecast. I came here January 1999, and our dear friend and former boss, Joe Ahern, then wanted us to just do a 5-day forecast because that's what everybody in the marketplace was doing. And I said, I'm claiming this as my idea, but it was, in a meeting with Joe and the former news director, 1999, I said, you know, since we are Channel 7 and weather technology now is advancing to the point that we can, there's more accuracy in our forecasting, we can go out on a limb a little bit farther now, why don't we do the 7-day forecast, linked to the brand name Channel 7 and ABC 7. And Joe and our news director resisted my suggestion at that point and said, oh, no, that's way too long a forecast period. People won't consider it reliable. 1 year later, they were saying, okay, let's go to a 7-day forecast. 1 year later.
And I can vouch for you because I remember, because I started in 2000, June of 2000.
Uh-huh, yep.
And Joe was big on, we're ABC 7,
yep.
days.
That's right. So we went to the 7-day forecast. And as you pointed out also, initially, Joe was clinging dearly to the old notion that the website wasn't that important to us. It wasn't useful. If you post our weather forecast on the website, nobody will watch our news. And, of course, he quickly came to realize that just the opposite was true, that there is a cross-promotional value between what we offer on the website and what we offer on our newscast and on all other local programming as well. So, anyhow, that was your starting point. Now, you went on to talk about the newspapers. Yes. Breaks my heart. The newspapers are dying out, and you are absolutely on target when you say that we in television news now, and not just in news, but even on shows like The View from the Bay, can provide that service, that beat reporting service or that specialty reporting service that newspapers have forever provided, and people who will miss their Chronicle. political beat or reporter or their Chronicle entertainment beat reporter can now tune in to us, and we can replace that need. We can fill that need and replace that element they're missing. We, in our newsroom, every single day, have pored over the newspapers looking for, as you said, in-depth reporting from the papers that can serve as, you know, source material, background information for us to do our TV reporting. Now, if the newspapers go away, you know, people who used to turn to the newspapers, we hope, will turn to us for that kind of reporting.
Absolutely.
And especially with in areas like investigative reporting. You know, the television news doesn't have the luxury of time to develop long, in-depth reports the way print can. But specialty reporters like Dan Noyes doing investigative reporting can take a little bit more time than the typical TV news story, which is like under 3 minutes. Dan can go, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 minutes with a big breaking investigative report. And so I hate to see newspapers die out, but I hope people who used to love the newspapers will now turn to local TV news.
Well, they need a reliable source, I think, is the main thing. And I remember, you know, and I tell people this all the time, one of the main things, because, you know, you choose your arguments in life, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm a pretty easygoing person. I don't like to argue. But I remember that, you know, the value that Dan provides just to individual people is huge. And the view from the Bay can provide is huge in helping people manage their time more efficiently.
Yep.
And be more connected to their families. But before the View from the Bay existed, I worked there, and I would work with Dan on the extra materials that he would have, as you said, for the cross-promotional value of, you know, being able to send people to the website. But in his case, he'd have a lot more material that he couldn't even include in a 5 to 6 minute segment. And some of the most interesting, so after I left ABC, the reason that I actually left was to go to Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. And
mm-hmm.
my journalism school professors, I would quiz constantly on, you know, making sure that people were aware that if they were going to endeavor in a broadcast medium, that lawyers for, you know, that are meant to protect companies like ABC, which is, of course, owned by Disney,
right,
are going to fight you tooth and nail on certain things. And one I remember in particular was, do we give out the new links that were coming out for information related to people that were sex offenders in neighborhoods?
Mm-hmm.
And would we have some sort of culpability if people were, you know, kind of chased down or considered the town leper, or you know the personal freedoms of those individuals,
sure,
versus
sure.
the right of people to be able to find this information. So I mean, you're constantly struggling between those two things, but I still think, you know, increasingly, you know, people just are letting that information out anyway. It's great to have the responsibility of these great organizations that have been around a long time.
Right.
I mean, that's
right.
The thing with ABC 7. I mean, people may remember it was in the Tenderloin, and I remember working with somebody, Maroney, who was on Michael Finney's team, had all these pictures, and he'd come over and he'd show me the pictures of the old building and the graffiti and all kinds of things. And people forget, I think, about the legacy of these local television stations, which I say to people, I did a seminar this week on social media, and I say, you know, we were kind of the first community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we're really trying to serve the people, you know, and I'm speaking as though I'm you, but, you know, you're really trying to serve the folks in your community and give them valuable information. I think that's
yeah. I could not agree more. And you cited such an important point there when you were talking about, when you gave the example of the sex offender and how much information we should report to the public and to what extent. You know, we wrestle in newsrooms, not just ours, but in newsrooms across the country. We wrestle every day with questions, ethical questions, like where does the public's right to know end and where does a person's individual freedom begin? You know, I think the public needs to know that we do ask ourselves these questions. We don't take what we do, our responsibility to the public, lightly. You know, there are individual exceptions, obviously, but generally across the board, journalists wrestle with these kinds of questions every day. We want the work that we do to be fair. We want it to be balanced. We want it to serve a useful purpose in the lives of our viewers, our customers, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, and from time to time, there will be sensationalism There will be heavy-handedness in reporting. There is also the occasional reporter who's more interested in self-promotion than in advancing a story, but that is the exception. It's not the rule. And something else you cited earlier is very important to underscore as well. You were talking about the fact that even in a 6 or 7 minute special investigative report by someone like Dan Noyes, there is still additional information that we don't have time to report, which is why we here at ABC7 started doing something over a year ago, called The Backstory, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And reporters will go on the newscast between 6 and 7 and do their 3, 4, or 5 minute report, and they'll say, and for more on this topic, go to our website and read my backstory, which will include a lot more information that we just did not have time to report in the one-hour newscast.
And we started doing that sort of, so we had garnered an Emmy nomination at one point for the coverage of the dog mauling trial,
mm-hmm.
And we for our website coverage, and one of the things we did there is our reporter would every day kind of talk about what it was like in the courtroom every day,
mm-hmm.
and people just love that. I mean, it provided so much context and kind of backed up some of the more salient points that she was, you know, sourcing in her stories.
There was just a little blip in our audio here. I didn't hear which trial you said you were referring to.
Oh, I'm sorry. The San Francisco dog mauling trial.
Oh, the dog mauling trial. Yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
the dog mauling trial. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and that was, you know, that was huge. I mean, that, you know, the ability to take the reporter from, you know, the courtroom in Los Angeles and be able to let local folks know, you know, here's kind of what the atmosphere was like
in the
room every day was such a, you know, it was contextual, but it was mm-hmm. personal. And I think that people really long to hear that perspective.
Yeah, they really do. And that ability that we have now to provide that kind of coverage of a story is also, I think, going to be a very attractive feature for people who miss their newspapers as the newspapers begin to fade away.
Yeah. Well, you know, I want to ask you, and you referred to, you know, the presidential election earlier. You know, we've had such major changes in the world recently. We've got a new president who, to many of us, represents this great new hope.
Mm-hmm.
While we're in the midst of this global economic downturn and people are constantly following the markets and, you know, just generally speaking, it's probably less, you know, applicable to the view from the Bay, but in editorial meetings and what's being covered overall at ABC7, how have these events changed either the stories that you're doing or that the station is doing?
Wow. That's, you know, you are great at asking big questions.
I'm not my size. I've only got an hour with you.
No, but I like this because these are thoughtful and engaging questions, and they trigger so many thoughts. I don't even know where to start, but I'll just jump in the middle of my stream of consciousness here. Well, first of all, let me go back to the presidential election last year. Yes, historic in many ways. You know, this man, Barack Obama, who represents hope and change, and he's a source of inspiration to so many people. And I'm sorry, get back to the question, narrow it down for me again. What's going on in newsrooms? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you've got, it's sort of like you have this juxtaposition of, you know, this new sense of hope. We have a new, you know, literally a new face in terms of world events.
Yeah.
But then you have the very real realities, and I'm sure, you know, this is something that I've seen, you know, that is reflected in what you're doing on A View from the Bay, which is people, you know, experiencing this horrible economic downturn.
Right.
I'm just curious how that is affecting either the tone, the cadence of all your stories, or kind of the stories that you're looking to do.
Yeah, okay. I got you now. Back on track. The economic downturn is having a powerful impact on what we do in this business because as the economy continues to weaken, advertisers are spending less money, which means that news operations and television stations are earning less revenue, and that cripples our ability to provide the kind of coverage that we would, the like to cover, that we like to provide, ideally. What do I mean by that? Well, when stations are making less money, they have to cut back on personnel. That means they can hire fewer reporters, fewer camera people. They can't spend as much money sending reporters out of town on assignments to cover stories that have a local tie-in. So we have to become very creative in our approach to news coverage. We still want to provide the best, most in-depth, most comprehensive coverage, most meaningful news coverage we can to our viewership, and yet we're operating on smaller budgets with, you know, with fewer resources, fewer people. It's a challenge. And yet at the same time that there is this challenging time happening with our economy, with the global economy, not just our local economy, there is also this great sense of hope that many people have, much of it because of the election of Barack Obama, this very inspiring figure. I find this an exciting time to be in the business because there are all these examples of ordinary people who are doing extraordinary things with their lives in these very difficult times. And when we go out to talk to people, these ordinary people doing these extraordinary things in our news coverage, they often say, well, you know, I'm inspired by the new leadership. It's a new day for the country. As you said, there's a new face on America, and the world is looking to us for leadership again. So, it's the best of times and it's the worst of times. And that's exciting to me. It reminds me of what inspired me to come into this business. I was in college in the late 1960s at a time of profound social and political change in the country. And, the civil rights bill was the civil rights movement was beginning to bear fruit. The women's movement was coming into its own. There was the anti-Vietnam War protest going on. There was a wave of student activism and across the country, and young people were embracing popular social and political causes. And I was, you know, a young person at that time in college in the late 60s, I was so fascinated by the way the news media covered the events of that era that I decided I wanted to become a journalist, and that's why I came into this business. So some of the same kinds of changes and challenges, if you'll pardon that little bit of alliteration there, are occurring right now. And this is an exciting time to be a journalist, and I think it's an exciting time to be an American. So as huge as these challenges are, as grave as the struggles are of many of our citizens because of the very difficult economy, I'm excited and hopeful about how we're going to meet these challenges. And I think, I mean, as a society, and I mean as an industry. And I think a year from now, we're going to see some positive changes.
So how does that affect the stories that you do or the questions that you ask? I remember, I was thinking when I was prepping for this, you had Naomi Campbell on talking about the Fashion Week maybe a year and a half ago or something.
Yep, that's
right. And, would you have even had her on? Would she have been lower in the totem pole of importance? Would the questions have been different? And those are the kinds of things I'm wondering about. You know, how is it really affecting your show, the stories you do, the questions you ask?
It's having a significant effect on the stories that we do, the guests we book, and the questions we ask. That's a great example. You know, a year and a half ago, when the economy was different and people weren't so worried and concerned about just day-to-day survival as they are now and how to make ends meet, people were more taken with the celebrity culture, and we would book guests like Naomi Campbell because they had drawing power and viewers would tune in. Now people want information from us on, how to send their kids to college on a shoestring budget, how to dress and look fashionable, how to prepare, good, tasty, gourmet-like meals at home for under $20. And so the topics we're booking now are designed more to say, here's how you can make ends meet. Here's how you can send the kids to school. Here's how you can save some money. Here's how you can go green without spending an arm and a leg. here's how you can look good and spend less. And the questions we're asking are changing, because when we bring guests on now, we're asking, you know, we're bringing people on who have faced adversity and who have not only survived but thrived. And we're saying, how did you do it? Share your story. You know, let our viewers know, let our the woman at home who's watching our show between 3 and 4 know how you started your business in this crazy economy when banks aren't lending money anymore. Give them some tips. So that's how the questions have changed. That's how our focus has changed as we're booking topics and booking guests. We want to give people useful information that help them make tough choices and simplify that process for them. We want to give them hope. We want to inspire them and let them know that, you know, although times are tough, you don't have to give in. You know, you can cope, you can thrive, you can survive. So that's pretty much how it's the focus for us has changed.
Yeah, I always think that's interesting because the company that I work at, Eastwick Communications, was founded during one of our dot busts. And it's a high-tech PR firm. So It's, you know, it's amazing just, you know, to hear the stories of kind of how it was founded and those sorts of things. So those stories, I think, you know, we're hardwired to hear the positives, which kind of leads me to my next question, which is, you know, the view from the Bay, I think, overall in terms of your of the lineup there at ABC7 is really often a refreshing lift from some of the heavier news. Mm-hmm. But overall, do you think people are you know, even though you're kind of trying to do the positive spin on things, in terms of the interaction you're having either with the guests the audience and maybe the feedback that you're getting generally, do you think people are just kind of getting tired of hearing negative stories?
Yeah, I think they are because, you know, I've been hearing for as long as I've been in the news business from viewers that they're tired of hearing negative stories and have always tried to make the point that, you know, we're not out there every day looking for negative stories. But the nature of news, sadly, is that much of what happens that affects our lives, that has an impact on our lives, tends to be of a negative nature. But let's get back to View from the Bay since we're not a newscast. People are tired of hearing negative stories, but that doesn't mean that we feel that we have to go out there and just give them upbeat stories, you know, for a whole hour. We try to give them inspiring stories that of people, you know, just like you, who've faced challenges and have had difficulty but found a way to overcome. And these aren't, you know, shallow, pie-in-the-sky stories. These are real-life stories of real-life people. So we try to offer them that. But I guess, you know, it's hard to put a label on a show like ours, and I hate to try to do it, but I'm going to try to do it. And I'm going to call us an infotainment show. You know, my basic approach to life and my basic personality, I think, is upbeat, hopeful, positive. And, of course, I like to inject humor into much of what I do. But our show is not just about that. It's not just about being upbeat. It's about, you know, being sensitive and letting our viewers know that we can relate to the problems that they're facing every day because we face them too. And we try to bring guests on our show with whom our viewers can feel a connection. And I personally try to avoid trivializing any important topic. It really bugs me because I think it happens a lot in the news these days, and you're going to get me off into a whole other topic here because I'm going to sound like, you know, an aging journalist attacking this young generation of reporters. I personally try not to trivialize any topic that we cover in the show. I'll give you an example of what I mean. The day after the presidential election, you know, everybody was talking about the historical significance of the first black president. Well, of course, that is a historic event that the United States of America, with its with slavery being one of the ugly chapters in our history, elected its first African-American president. But I went on the top of the show that day, and I said, you know, that's a significant thing, but that I don't think that's the most significant thing about this election. I think the most significant thing about the election is not that we elected a black man president, but that we elected this man president, This man who inspires so many people for so many reasons having nothing to do with race. You know, people invested hope in this person because he provided a vision for the future, for where he felt the country should go and could go. And, you know, he's inspired young people to get involved in the political process again. He's made the political process relevant to young people again. And, you know, he's inspired people who've come from one-parent homes because he came from one. So I said, you know, the importance of this election goes way beyond just considerations of race. And I'm not trying to say that I'm a sage, but I felt that kind of statement was so absent from much of the news reporting that I saw, even on the major networks, about the election. So that's the sort of approach that I try to carry to the View from the Bay. We want to be positive and upbeat, and we want people to be entertained. We want them to be informed, but we also want to encourage them to think a little bit deeper, you know, and look beyond the surface of a story and look for its deeper meaning.
Yeah, absolutely, because I think a lot of people can relate. You know, for example, you know, I think there was a major lack of absence, you know, given his roots as a community organizer and how hard his mother worked to provide him with opportunity, but the socioeconomic part that, you know, binds a lot of different races together, mm-hmm. And is really a unifying factor. We're at about the halfway point, so I just want to reintroduce folks that are joining us, that we're on Break Through the Noise right now with me, Jennifer Lindsay of Eastwick Communications, and I'm chatting to Spencer Christian of ABC7 fame and many other things. And wanted to kind of shift gears a little bit, knowing you personally a little bit and knowing how you're a wine enthusiast.
Oh, yeah.
You are a fantastic parent by all accounts. Oh. I was curious to ask you about your kids and if they influence, you know, these new technologies. We've talked about them in the context of work, but has any of that sort of come full circle where, you know, maybe they're on Facebook or they're on Twitter, they're talking about these things and it's influenced you to maybe look into something that's come into the newscast or become a story idea?
Yeah. Well, my kids, first of all, my kids are the greatest source of joy in my life. I'm such a cornball dad when it comes to talking about my kids. My son Jason is 34 and my daughter Jessica will very soon turn 31. So my kids aren't very young.
They're thrilled that you just said that. Poor Jessica.
Jessica is in New York. She lives in Manhattan. She's the associate director of admissions at a very exclusive private girls' school in Manhattan.
Oh, fantastic.
And Jason used to work in the TV business as a sports producer. But he got fed up with the business and what he called shallow people with colossal egos. he and his wife recently moved here to the Bay Area, and he works with my new wife in her business staging homes for real estate sales. But anyhow, my kids, you know, I thought they were on the cutting edge of technology like 10 years ago when I first moved here. And, you know, they helped me set up an email account because I didn't know how to do that. And in fact, I had not done any email on my own prior to moving here 10 years ago when I was back at Good Morning America. And, you know, everybody was computer – well, not everybody, but most people were computer literate except me. I guess I was like John McCain. And I didn't do my own email before 1998. So my kids helped me learn those primitive skills, we consider them now, like doing email. But I don't think either of my kids has a Facebook account, and I don't think they're on Twitter yet either. I'm pretty sure that they don't have Facebook accounts. I know that for sure, even though I just set one up for myself earlier this week because I had about 80 friends who kept emailing me saying,
probably including me,
join. Including you, join. And now that I've joined, you know where to find me.
Exactly.
So I guess my kids aren't really the, you know, like the high tech types. They have iPods and iPhones and all that stuff, but they're not on the cutting edge.
It'll be interesting, Jessica. So how old are the students that she's?
Oh, well, her school is called the Spence School. You may have heard of it.
Of course, Gwyneth Paltrow went there.
Gwyneth Paltrow went there. That's exactly right.
And Maya Rudolph went there.
That's right. And Charlie Gibson's wife, Arlene Gibson, used to be the head of school there, but she retired a couple of years ago. The school is K-12, and Jessica deals mainly with the upper school, I believe, which would be 7-12. But she interviews families that are applying for admission, even to the lower school, and quite a big responsibility she's got there.
I think it's going to be interesting to see over the next few years. You'll have to check in with me about if she ends up using, or her staff end up using, social networks to check in on students and see the types of things they're blogging about, even their families, and that influence the kinds of folks that, you know, to make, you know, to help get more context about, you know, who gets admitted for the, you know, the work that I'm sure she does to try to kind of create an interesting environment for these bright students to really excel in. So there's some diversity in various ways. I think that'll be interesting to see. But I want, you know, on the personal front, what stories are you personally interested in hearing about?
Wow. You know, I'm a news junkie, and I'm curious about everything in the world. I'm a political junkie, so I'm always following politics closely. I'm a big sports fan, so I follow sports. I love food and wine, as you know. Yeah, you too? Yeah. And I love food and wine. Giants fan, yeah. I hate to tell you, I'm a lifelong Dodger fan. Would you believe that? Let me tell you why. Let me tell you why. I grew up on the East Coast, and I'm old, Jennifer. I'm going to be 62 this year, so I remember the Brooklyn Dodgers.
God.
So I grew up a Brooklyn Dodger fan. But
so
because
you and Larry King are together on that, but at least
exactly.
He admires our manager. You know,
I love your manager, and I love the whole management team here for the Giants, and I love the ballpark, and I love the history of the Giants, because Willie Mays, I think, is the greatest all-around baseball player who ever lived.
Can you believe it when they are able to just pull him on the field? It seems like he's just there all the time.
I watched Willie Mays play ball when I was a little kid. But I grew up a Brooklyn Dodger fan. But I wasn't from New York. I grew up in Virginia. So when the Dodgers moved to L.A., unlike New York fans who were all heartbroken and ticked off, it didn't affect me because I wasn't from New York. So I transferred my allegiance. And, you know, so when I was a teenager, you know, I was watching guys like Sandy Koufax and Don Drysdale and great Dodger names from the past. And, of course, I was very aware of the bitter rivalry between the Dodgers and Giants. So now that I'm here, I tone down my loyalty to the Dodgers when I go on the air.
Yes,
but anyhow,
let's not talk about Manny Ramirez then.
Manny, oh yeah, yeah, who settled for a mere $45 million for 2 years. Yeah.
Oh,
way to go, Manny. Way to win friends and influence people. But you know, the stories I'm interested in, beyond the topics I mentioned, you know, politics and sports and food and wine, are really those everyday stories of the people I referred to earlier, the ordinary people who do extraordinary things with their lives. I mean, the guy last week who tried to perform CPR on one of the slain police officers in Oakland. You know, people who see someone in need and will stop and lend a helping hand without regard for their own safety. I love stories like the story of Captain Sullenberger, you know. I just love those human interest stories of people who do extraordinary things because of their concern for other people's well-being. That really touches my heart deeply.
Yeah, I think I totally agree. In fact, you know, I think a lot of people have kind of become hardened over the years and forget that a lot of well-known TV personalities still feel that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, I certainly, you know, tried to carry that through my entire career. I always tell people, you know, the worst thing sometimes a broadcaster can do is publish a book.
Yeah.
as your son Jason pointed, you know, as you pointed out, your son Jason, you know, kind of the fatigue of some of the ego-driven as opposed to conscience-driven reporting that happens. And I, you know, my mom was the biggest Joan London fan, and, you know, nothing against Joan London. I'm sure she's a lovely person. She obviously loves her family dearly. But when her book came out, my mom was no longer a Good Morning America fan. She's only really come back around in the last few years because she felt this tremendous sense of, wow, this, you know, I had thought she was from Sacramento, you know, native Californian like me, and, you know, we had this connection, and suddenly she felt like, oh, she's really different than me. She sees herself as an elite. She sees herself this certain way. So I think that, you know, that's, it's an interesting thing that you bring up, because I think that that relatability really does come through on your program.
Yeah,
you know,
I hope so.
You know, and I think that you are, you know, one of the people, and one of the reasons I asked you to come on is because I think you do, I mean, you've already now shared a lot of personal stories with us, and I think that that's that behind-the-scenes piece that really does drive the questions that you ask. So of course, a lot of things are going to be off the cuff, right?
Yeah, and, that's right. That's
and,
right.
And you see people's values kind of come through. And kind of on that front, I'm wondering, you know, how much, if any, influence do you usually have in the kinds of story ideas and personalities that are coming on your program? Kind of give people the behind-the-scenes look of, like, how something comes, you know, how the idea comes about, and then how does it end up on air?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a fairly democratic process, democratic with a small d. we have a large staff of producers, production assistants, of course, two hosts, Janelle Wang and I are the hosts, and we have our executive producer, Maggie Baxter, and our programming director, David Salinger. And every single day we have a production meeting at 10 a.m., and there is an open exchange of ideas. We, on our show, we who work on the show, are approached by publicists throughout the day with ideas for topics and guests. But viewers also email or write us and offer suggestions for topics and guests. And those of us who work on the show have our own ideas. So there's this open exchange of ideas and suggestions. And then we, as a group, we sort of agree on which topics we think will have the broadest appeal to our viewers or will be the most useful topics for our viewers. The final word lies with our executive producer, Maggie Baxter, but Maggie's not a dictator. She doesn't say, this is what we're going to do, but she does have the ultimate say. If there's healthy debate about whether or not a topic's right for our show, she gets to say yes or no in the end.
And how many stories do you guys sort of aim for to do, or topics?
Yeah.
I should say it's probably the better vernacular for this. So how many topics do you try to aim to cover in an hour?
We do about seven each day. Now, when I say seven, sometimes two or three of those topics may be related to each other. You know, they may fall under the same general category. For example, we do two cooking segments almost every single day. Sometimes the segment may be with a chef from a Bay Area restaurant. Sometimes it may be with a winemaker who's pairing his or her wine with the food that's being cooked on the show. Sometimes it may be a cookbook author. But we do two food segments each day. We do fashion, makeup, health, especially women's health, fitness. And when I say fitness, I don't just mean exercise. We do exercise segments from time to time on the show, but sometimes the fitness segments will involve nutrition and, you know, personal well-being. We do relationship stuff, parenting topics, high-tech
segments. You do a lot of digital lifestyle stuff.
Yeah, lifestyle.
You know, I mean,
yeah.
You know, because consistently, that's something that comes up for everyone. It's sort of, mm-hmm. you know, like you were saying, with the integration of email into your life, right, on a very one-on-one basis, you know, and creating a Facebook account, those sorts of things. I've seen
exactly.
those types of things on your program.
Well, we did a segment just yesterday on it was called Facebook 101, you know, and basically the approach to our viewers was, you know, you probably know many people who are on Facebook. Your kids are probably on Facebook. In case you don't know what it is and how it works, here to explain it is so-and-so-and-so-and-so. And we went on to talk about, Facebook and other social networking websites.
Yeah, I actually gave a seminar, and I was really wondering if your wife might have been in it, to a group of design professionals in San Francisco. I do a lot of sort of informational sessions, but are, mm-hmm. you know, I'll do Facebook 101 or, you know, social media 101. So, you know, just to get, you know, to get people feeling empowered.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that's it. We want people to feel empowered. Exactly. And that's one of the things, one of our goals each day is to empower our viewers. Yeah. We want them to walk away from the broadcast feeling that they learned something that is useful in their lives and has made it easier for them to deal with the challenges that they face in their everyday lives.
I think that's great. Yeah. I wanted to ask you, you know, over the course of your career, and so, you know, include everything, five most memorable stories, either because of newsworthiness or some other factor.
Wow. I don't know if I can narrow it down to five very quickly, but I'll try. One of my most memorable assignments was covering the great Midwest floods in 1993. I don't know if you remember what happened, but in the summer of 1993, there was massive flooding throughout the Midwest from the top of the Mississippi River down to the bottom. So from you know, Minnesota and Wisconsin all the way down to Louisiana to the Gulf Coast, there was massive flooding. And for 3 weeks, Good Morning America sent me out to the tri-state area of Illinois, Iowa, and Missouri. I saw heartbreaking devastation from the floods, people who lost all their material possessions, everything they had ever owned and worked for, and had nothing left but the will to live and to survive. And, you know, I could go on and tell you about individual stories, but the bottom line is that was one of my most memorable assignments, because that's when I began using the expression reporting on ordinary people who've done extraordinary things with their lives. I was just so profoundly touched by the determination that people showed to, you know, to cope with this disaster, with this loss of all material possessions, and to rebuild their lives. It was incredible. I also have covered a couple of major political conventions. Back in 1988, I covered the Democratic and Republican conventions. And that was exciting just because I'm such a political junkie. 1988 wasn't the most significant political year in our history, but being at the conventions was kind of interesting. I worked with Jimmy and Rosalynn Carter on Habitat for Humanity for about 4 days. And Good Morning America sent me to Washington, D.C. Well, Good Morning America didn't send me. The Carters invited me to work with them on Habitat for Humanity. So GMA allowed me to do my live broadcasts each morning from the site of the houses we're building. That was a very interesting assignment. I've been in 14 hurricanes and floods, blizzards, and all kinds of natural disasters, but one of my most memorable reporting assignments was actually covering the Loma Prieta earthquake and its aftermath here in the Bay Area, because I was here for the World Series in 1989 for Good Morning America. Not doing play-by-play. I was doing a World Series-related features, you know, like interviewing some of the more interesting characters on the two teams. As it turns out, the A's were the ones who really had the interesting characters. The Giants were kind of a boring
do.
Yeah, they were a boring team that year, the poor Giants. So I was here for World Series coverage when the Loma Prieta earthquake hit. I was on the 19th floor of the St. Francis Hotel. The building was bouncing up and down and swaying back and forth, and I thought the building was going to collapse and I was going to die right there. So I ran down 14 flights of stairs, probably faster than Carl Lewis. And then I was here for the next 10 days doing, you know, post-earthquake coverage and the resumption of the World Series. So that was a memorable assignment. I stayed at the ranch of Alex Haley, the author of Roots, for a couple of days, and did a series of reports or some ongoing reporting on him and his life for Good Morning America. That was pretty memorable. I could go on and on.
You got one more.
One more. Okay.
Yeah.
You know what? Interviewing Barack Obama here on The View from the Bay about 6 weeks before he announced his candidacy was one of my most memorable assignments, because everyone knew this guy was going to run for president. Everyone knew that he was soon going to announce his candidacy, but there was this wave of anticipation. You know, everybody was so excited, wondering, you know, when will he do it and what's he going to say? And here I was with this wonderful opportunity to engage this fascinating young political figure and try to find out what made him tick, and to ask him questions about, you know, the audacity of hope and how he could convey his sense of hope and optimism to the country and inspire other people to feel the same way. And that was a memorable interview. I still have it on DVD, and I play it back every once in a while.
Is there anything that he said that you remember that you just, you look back now and you go, wow?
You know,
it was different than maybe, you know, that he said on the campaign trail, for example.
He said something about wanting to be a different kind of politician who tried to bridge the gaps between disparate groups in the country and wanting to bring people together. But he said it in a way that didn't sound corny. It wasn't just the same old, you know, political rhetoric about I know how to reach across the aisles. He really seemed to be speaking from the heart, and I can't remember the words he used, but I remember that when he looked into my eyes and made that statement about wanting to unify the country, I really felt like he meant it. I mean, it was just a powerfully gripping moment, and I thought, this guy really has something special, and he really cares about, or at least that was my take, he really cares about the country. You know, he loves the country, and he wants to see it unified, not fractured. And so I'd have to go back and play the thing back, I guess, to get his exact words. But it was his answer to that question that stayed with me.
And that is exactly what I would have followed up with, was what was it like to look into his eyes, and you immediately said that. So I thought that was really interesting what you just said.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, that had to be a fascinating moment. But that's
yeah.
Good list of stories. Those brought back some memories of people telling me about what happened actually at the station and like sleeping there for days after Loma Prieta and where they were. And I remember in the 93 floods myself, I had been an LBJ congressional intern. I was a student at Cal. I decided to go by train, so I took the northern route out to D.C., and then I came back I took the southern route out and then took the northern route back, and
yeah.
We got stuck
yeah.
in the floods. A lot of tracks were barely together, and the train was running out of food. So, I mean, that was something that, you know, it just brings back so many memories when you talk about these stories, because I think we all have these personal connections. And I know we only have a few more minutes, but I just have to ask you, other reporters or media personalities you respect or admire?
Oh, boy. Well, let me go back to my youth, first of all. The first broadcast journalist I sort of looked to as, not I wouldn't say a role model, but as someone I deeply admired, was David Brinkley. Because he was smart, he knew history, he was able to take the events on which he reported and put them in historical perspective so that you understood their connection to the past. And he also didn't take himself too seriously. You know, he had that offbeat sense of humor that said, basically, I take the news seriously, but I don't take myself seriously. And I like that about him. So it's kind of self-deprecating. Among today's current crop of journalists, Charlie Gibson is just one of my favorites. I love Charlie dearly. I mean, we work together, so he's a dear friend. We were on Good Morning America together for 12 years or so. But I really like the way he approaches the news. I also like George Stephanopoulos. I liked the late Tim Russert. There are others whose names don't immediately come to mind, but those stand out.
What do you think of the newbies? Well, you know, he's not necessarily a newbie, but Keith Olbermann and the Rachel Maddows. I mean, they definitely have a point of view.
Yeah.
But what do you think of them? I mean, Rachel
I like
Maddow, Castro Valley. So she's
yeah, from Castro Valley,
girl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like them both because they're so smart. And I often happen to agree with their point of view, but that's not why I like them, because there are many people whose points of view I agree with, but I don't feel they have a whole lot to say. But they're smart, they're thoughtful, they've got substance, and I think that's something that is sorely lacking among many of the newbies in our business. And I don't want to name names, because that just there's no need to do that. But when I look at CNN, the person I want to hear speak there is David Gergen, not mm-hmm. most of the newbies, you know.
Yeah.
But at MSNBC, well, Olbermann's not a newbie either. He's almost my age. But Rachel Maddow is certainly a newbie, and she is really smart and thought provoking and engaging. So yeah, I like her a lot.
Well, that's fantastic, and we'll end on that positive note for local girl Rachel Maddow. from Castro Valley. Went to Castro Valley High School.
Yep.
And I want to
And she's a Rhodes Scholar, too.
Yes, she's a Rhodes Scholar. She has so many accomplishments. Very smart gal. But I want to thank you, Spencer, for taking the time to speak with me and our audience, and thank the audience for tuning in to Break Through the Noise with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Next week, our guest is Kevin Spear of Bunchball, a technology company that takes the word community to a whole new level. And that's 1 week from today at 12:30 p.m. Pacific. As always, you can keep in touch with the latest on this show and Eastwick Communications in general at blog.eastwick.com. Have a great weekend, and thanks so much for listening.